Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
I know there's been a lot of talk about we're sort of moving towards a multipolar world. You know, the U.S. isn't going to be the only superpower. Do you think that's where things are headed, or what is the way
forward? Already there. I mean, you know, why didn't they win the war in Afghanistan? Well, you could have tactical explanations. But the basic thing, as I just said, is they couldn't confront Pakistan. They wouldn't confront a regional power there. So already we have a multipolar world. You know, why couldn't they win in Iraq? Well, because to do that, you'd have to invade Syria and invade Iran as well. You know, you have Trump, you know, a U.S. force, you know, in northeast Syria looking to intimidate Assad and do lots of other things there. And what's really dishonest is say these things could be done, but by the way, we'll need 150,000 troops and it'll probably take us 10 years and we still might win, you know. So I think we already are in a multipolar world.
Hey, Parallax News listeners! On this edition of the program, we are joined by one of the most prolific Middle East war correspondents around. He's been at it since the 1970s, Patrick Coburn, and he has a brand new book entitled War in the Age of Trump, The Fall of ISIS, The Betrayal of the Kurds, and the Conflict with Iran. Patrick's experience speaks for itself, and he has a lot to say about the assassination of General Soleimani, the situation of the Kurds, the isolationism of Donald Trump, and the failures of the Western elite foreign policy establishment over the past decades. I want to get right into the conversation, so let's get straight to it. Here's Patrick Coburn, author of War in the Age of Trump, The Fall of ISIS, The Betrayal of the Kurds, and The Conflict with Iran.
This is Mimi Kennedy, and 2020-2020, votersplural, calendar.org. 2020, voterscalendar.org is where you can find information on the detailed rules that could trip you up in the election if you don't know them, and we will give you links all the way down to your county website with phone numbers so that you can be sure that the information you're working with is absolutely correct.
Welcome to Parallax Views, veteran war reporter and author of the new book, War in the Age of Trump, The Fall of ISIS, The Betrayal of the Kurds, The Conflict with Iran. Patrick Coburn, thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you so much.
So, Patrick, I want to get into this book, and I know there's developments in the Middle East as we speak, but first, if I could, I hope this isn't getting into too personal of a question, but I know you've been doing Middle East reporting since 1979 and the Iranian Revolution, and you don't really necessarily allow your personal self to get into the stories, but I'm curious, how have you been able to maintain
a career in war reporting, because I feel like, you know, watching the bombs go off in October in the hills of Afghanistan and in 2001 and seeing incidents like that, I assume it would take a toll, or at least it would be surreal to witness all these things.
I suppose it does take a toll, but, you know, it doesn't, not to be sort of overly modest, it's not as bad as being an ordinary Afghan who can't get out of the country. You know, I've been doing, you said 1979, actually 75, I first came to the Middle East, to Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War. The strain is less if you can get out and people there can't. The strain is also less if you don't have a family with you. And of course, you know, if you're worried, most people worry more about their children than they do about themselves. If you're a Lebanese or an Iraqi or an Afghan, and you hear the shells and bombs going off and the rattle of gunfire, and you know your children are just coming back from school, you know, then you get really frightened. And I don't have that. You know, there've also been gaps. I mean, I haven't had to do it the whole time. But yeah, I mean, you're right. It is a strain.
In that regard, the only other question I wanted to ask before getting into the book itself is, you know, Robert Fisk, another veteran war correspondent, has said that, you know, there's difficulty with this idea of being objective when doing war reporting, because you're, you know, seeing the human cost of these wars. I was wondering what you think of that. When it, how does one maintain objectivity in war reporting, or is it, you know, is it something that isn't necessarily completely possible?
Well, you know, one seeks to be objective, but objectivity is a strange thing. You know, the facts one selects as significant require one's own judgment. I think people often have the wrong idea about facts. You know, that they're like sort of chunks of gold lying about in the Yukon. They're not. They're the facts you choose require judgment, and hopefully that's good judgment. But the idea that, you know, there's a set number of facts and you go and look at them and you find them and you put them in your little pack and then you present them to the reader or the viewer, I think is naive. What you really need is good judgment, and that is really what people mean by objectivity.
Now, getting into war in the age of Trump, it seems like most of the commentary on Donald Trump and his foreign policy thus far has been really based on a sort of, in some ways, almost histrionic, maybe that's too strong of a word, idea that, oh, everything he does is sort of a pathology. Whereas it seems like you take him somewhat seriously compared to a lot of other reporters. Maybe you could talk about your feelings when Trump first became elected and why you took his thinking on foreign policy seriously, or what he was saying he was thinking.
Yes, that's a good point. I mean, from the beginning, I did take him seriously. I remember the presidential election in 2016. I was in Erbil in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish areas, and the siege of Mosul was about to begin. I always took him seriously as a populist. I think in many ways a genuine isolationist in the American tradition. And I thought it was always a mistake for people in 2016 and later to just see everything that Trump did as just another expression of sort of dysfunctional madness. Although, you know, it was often dysfunctional, it was often a bit crazy. But certain perceptions were correct, which is that all these countries are in a terrible mess, that the US was had military forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, that these wars seem to be endless. And one has to remember, or as we get towards the presidential election, that Trump hasn't actually started any wars in the Middle East. This is quite important. And a lot of people thought that he would, as they took this sort of bombast, belligerent bombast seriously. I think people also tended to, particularly CNN and the New York Times and the sort of big media, tended to say Trump is over here, you know, this is childish nonsense, and over here we have the grown-ups. Do you remember that? I don't know if that phrase is still used, but it was always pretty silly. You actually looked at what the grown-ups were proposing, intervention in Syria, and you read, you know, their thoughts about what was happening in Syria and Iraq, and they were just as clueless as Trump was, except they were planning greater intervention and he wasn't. Now, I don't want to sound too much as though I'm a sort of cheerleading for Trump there, because many of the things he did were catastrophic, by suddenly telling the Turks that it was okay to invade northern Iraq, northern Syria, I mean, you know, ending up with an even greater mess, in a sense, and that the U.S. pulled out of. Pulled military out of northern Syria and then sent it back in again to the oil fields. So you had a messy, fragile situation before, and you have one to this day. But it's a mistake to think that the alternatives to Trump, the alternative people to Trump, actually had much idea what they were doing.
The word that I noticed you used in the book, it's not so much that Trump has coherent ideas about foreign policies so much as he has I think a sense of instincts is how you put it. Maybe you could elaborate on that idea of his instincts and how it relates to some of the events that have happened with regards to war in the Middle East since his presidency began.
Well, there's an instinct that these are really messy situations that is completely correct. There's an instinct as I said, that these wars are endless and the U.S. isn't really going to win them. But it's, you know, it's a funny mixture, because I think U.S., the tradition of U.S. isolationism or U.S. Nationalism, really, or chauvinism, is that there's a mixture of isolationism, that we don't really want to be involved with foreigners. But insofar as we do want to be involved with foreigners, we know we want to bash them. We want to, you know, it's very militaristic as well. And that militarism is genuine. And it's a funny mixture, which I think you never quite know which is going to come out and on top. You could see that at the beginning of this year, on was January 3rd, that this year that Trump ordered the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian sort of chief operational officer for Iraq and Syria and Lebanon. Very aggressive, very dangerous, you know, but then that's it. You know, then the U.S., Trump stands back and watches the Iranians fire missiles into U.S. bases. You know, people, I think at that time, I think didn't really take on board. That's a very peculiar thing for this guy who's seen as sort of belligerent, blowhard, you know, that anybody who does anything to the U.S. is really going to, you know, be hit. And he just stands back and watches the Iranians fire missiles into U.S. bases, saying that no U.S. troops have been injured, which turned out to be somewhat untrue. But so there is that mix. And of course, Trump brings chaos. He brings disorganization, you know, disorganization. There's this being close to these, you know, very toxic dictators and monarchs, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, the U.S., for a country like the U.S., you know, to be see as its best friends very openly.
North Korea or Putin in Russia?
Or? Yeah, but also these monarchs, you know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, what was the American War of Independence all about? It's getting rid of a monarch, and suddenly, you know, he's courting these monarchs. He did discover that these guys are a bit crazy, and secondly, you know, their own ventures are pretty disastrous. Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, has had a whole sort of collection of fiascos attached to his name since. He intervenes in Yemen, which is meant to be a quick war. It's still going on.
Humanitarian disaster, yeah.
Yeah, complete disaster. He murders Khashoggi. You know, all these different actions are all pretty disastrous. So I imagine that Trump's sort of reliance on them has gone down. Just going back to the point I was making at the beginning, I think just a simple condemnation of Trump and just thinking it's all baloney is oversimple and wrong. It's also, as we get close to the presidential election, a bit dangerous because it leads to a presumption that Biden and the others, because of their long experience, that this is going to be an awful lot better. Because, you know, what's their experience been? You know, the Afghan war, the Syrian, the Iraqi war, all these other interventions over the last 20 years are pretty well, without exception, ended disastrously, and nobody's ever taken responsibility.
That's actually something I wanted to get into. Now, I don't consider them to have the sort of same worldview, but, you know, I think there's a similarity in a way between Trump and Obama in so much as I think they both had issues with this idea of the Washington playbook when it came to foreign policy. Yeah, I mean, there was the national security advisor for Obama, Ben Rhodes, referred to the foreign policy blob. It seemed like Obama, though, had issues with the way foreign policy was being carried out by the Washington playbook, as he put it, and yet he sort of resigned himself to it.
I think Obama was always resigning himself to things, you know, over his whole political career, and particularly in the Middle East. I remember, you know, he went to Cairo and made a progressive speech, but there always seemed to be two Obamas, which is the guy who made, you know, was the slightly stand back intellectual, making progressive, often very intelligent speeches, and a policy which didn't really change much. The US had military force in Afghanistan. They stayed there, you know, although we had reservations about reinforcing them. He did that. He had doubts about intervention, so he says, in Libya, but that happened with catastrophic results for the poor Libyans. The one thing he didn't do was launch a limited attack on Syria in, when was it, 2013. And he was, you know, later said in a famous interview that this was the moment that he stood up against the foreign policy establishment. I'm not sure, you know, this was going to be a limited intervention anyway. But in all cases, he was pretty well correct that the U.S. was on a hiding to nowhere there. He didn't go along with that. But he didn't, you know, it was really how much really changed under Obama? Very little, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because I often wonder what would have happened if Obama had pursued that, you know, pushing back against that idea of the foreign policy blob. But I guess we'll never know. I do think there's a connection, though, in that there is no real change in policy from Bush to Obama. And then we get to Trump, who is just pure isolationism and fed up with the, you know, interventions not working.
There's that. I mean, there's the other aspect, of course, which was Trump torpedoing the agreement with Iran, having the policy of maximum pressure on Iran. That was different. what has been the consequences? Well, clearly bad relations with Iran. It hasn't quite led to war yet, but it's got quite close. You know, at the time of the assassination of Soleimani, war wasn't that far off. So there's always been this sort of crazy element in Trump's ventures in the Middle East, because you don't quite know which way he's going to go. The people in the White House don't know which way he's going to go. And also, policies being put together by Trump with his own sort of particular isolationist, sort of populist, chauvinist approach, you know, assisted by various sort of full-blooded neoconservatives who want a sort of full-scale sort of imperial American intervention in the Middle East. You know, the guys who really learned nothing from what happened in Iraq or Libya or from any of these previous military interventions.
Now, with regards to Soleimani, that's how you start out the book. I want to talk about that because I think a lot of the media coverage of it is sort of spun in this way. I mean, the Trump administration and other administrations, whenever there's these assassinations that happen, it's sort of like a PR coup for whichever administration is in power. What, in your view, beyond that sort of image that is pervaded by the administration, what is the fallout from Soleimani's assassination?
Well, first of all, you're quite right. You know, the journalists and the media love assassinations because they're melodramatic, because they can be portrayed as a turning point in history. Politicians love them in the same way. Again and again, this turns out not to be true. The elimination of a leader doesn't make much difference. You know, one thinks of Osama bin Laden, and with Obama and Hillary Clinton sort of gathering to watch it in a rather ghoulish way, it didn't make much difference. The death of Gaddafi, Libya did make a difference, a really bad one for Libyans, since the whole place is torn apart by a sort of endless civil war. Al-Baghdadi, ISIS was already defeated. And then we get to Soleimani. I thought people got Soleimani wrong. I thought he was, here was a guy who was sort of kind of an expert in a sort of mixture of guerrilla attacks and never quite rising to the level of war. But he got very pleased with himself. The Iraqi government got very irritated by him. He was always sort of popping up on with sort of paramilitary units and having sort of selfies with them. You could see the sort of endlessly on Facebook and elsewhere.
He seems like a man that was possessed by a certain hubris and maybe some aspirations politically.
It really happens to a lot of generals, whether it's MacArthur or Soleimani. And it certainly happened to him. He seems to have been behind this sort of wholesale attack on protesters in Baghdad, which started in sort of the end of September, beginning of October last year. I was in Baghdad at the time. And there were these protests over corruption, jobs, lack of electricity and water, which had been going on every week in the center of Baghdad, and weren't really getting up much momentum. And suddenly the security forces and pro-Iranian elements opened fire on the protesters. And I remember the first night they killed 10 of them. I was in my hotel room, not so far away, and I heard this sort of pop, pop, pop of gunfire. And that's not uncommon in Baghdad, because almost everybody has a gun at weddings and funerals. They often fire guns into the air, or even, the victory of their favorite football club. Certainly much of it. And then it seemed to go on an awful long time. Went down to the hotel lobby, and the guys sort of rushed into the lobby saying they just killed 10 people. And they ended up by killing 600 people. And the people they were killing were Iraqi Shia. These are the guys who looked to Iran, had looked sympathetically to Iran as the Shia great power. And these guys were being shot down by pro-Iranian paramilitaries and guys in the Iraqi security services who look primarily to Iran. And this was under the orders of Soleimani. So I thought that Soleimani was pursuing a disastrous policy, which was alienating the sort of constituency to which Iran had been looking. In other words, there were the Shia Muslims, who are two-thirds of the Iraqi population. I think I quote in a piece, you know, there's an old saying, never interrupt your enemy when he's in the middle of making a mistake. And in a way, the U.S. got rid of Soleimani when he was making a very big mistake. So what's happened since then? Well, you have the Iranians taking a more cautious approach. I think they want to see U.S. troops out of Iraq. They don't necessarily want Iraq to be the arena for a contest with the between Iran and the U.S. I don't think at the end of the day it will damage their position that much, because Iraq always balances between Iran and the U.S. And, you know, currently there's a U.S. There's an Iraqi prime minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi. He's just been in Washington seeing Trump in the last few days. But, you know, how does he come to be prime minister? Well, he was considered rather sort of pro-American before, but he's only there because the Iranians went along with it. You know, so you have this curious system of this extreme animosity between Iran and the U.S. But they also sort of covertly cooperate.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm not putting forward a conspiracy theory, because Iraqis say, oh, yes, you know, they shake their fists at each other over the table, but they shake hands under the table. It's not quite like that. But at a certain point, they kind of have to deal with each other.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a very interesting relationship that Iran and Washington have, because they're sort of adversarial, but they do cooperate at certain points. A very strange relationship indeed.
It's very weird, and it's been going on for 30 years. You know, I remember in the sort of 90s, you know, to have, you know, the sort of Iranian Revolutionary Guards. This was up in a place called Salahuddin in Kurdistan, in sort of one ruined hotel in this place. And sort of down the road, you'd have the sort of pro-Americans and the CIA in another house. And they wouldn't sort of talk directly, but they'd talk through local Kurds. So this has gone on a long time and really hasn't changed very much.
Now, in regards to Iran and the U.S., I'm assuming I have listeners that are maybe just getting interested in foreign policy issues. I have a lot of younger listeners who are in college studying this stuff now. Why has this been going on for so long? I mean, you had the hostage crisis. Why is Iran and the U.S. always at odds with each other?
You have the overthrow of Mossadegh, the prime minister, by the U.S. and the British in 1953, basically because they wanted to keep control of Iranian oil. They're much more explicit about that then. And Mossadegh had been elected democratically. They overthrew him. They reinstalled the Shah. The Shah was their man. The Shah never really sort of recovered from the way he was reintroduced into Iran as a sort of foreign proxy, and then he gets overthrown by Khomeini, and you have the sort of humiliation of the U.S. embassy being taken over and the diplomats being held hostage. The portrayal of Iran as a great sort of threat was always exaggerated then, exaggerated now. Iran has a certain amount of power. It's also the leading Shia power. That's very important in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, because the Shia are either in power in Syria, or they're the largest community in Lebanon, and they're the majority in Iraq. So that gave them influence. But otherwise, that was sort of generally sort of threat enhancement, particularly grotesque, you know, under Trump, pretending that anything that they didn't like in the Middle East was sort of done by the Iranians.
Something that's always confused me to some extent before reading more of your work was, you know, it seems as if, you know, the war on terror, is against these Wahhabist and Salafist terrorist elements, which seem to come from a sort of radical sect of Sunni Islam. So one would think that Shia sort of controlled Iran would be an ally to the U.S. in the so-called war on terror. Why is that not the case?
Oh, because, you know, everybody, including particularly the U.S., describes anybody they don't like as a terrorist, you know. This gets sort of becomes ludicrous in Syria, where the Kurds in Turkey and northern Syria, which were basically controlled by the same organization, with whom the U.S. is cooperating in northern Syria as our brave and noble allies. And in Turkey, exactly the same bunch of guys are on the list of being terrorists, whom we're very happy to see the Turks shoot, imprison, and torture. So, you know, that's it's just become a term of abuse. But since 9/11, you know, the particularly the neoconservatives, I think, in the U.S., who wanted intervention, used the sort of outrage over 9/11 to fuel the invasion of Iraq. Although one thing that was completely certain is the Iraqis and Saddam Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with it, as everybody told them, and they knew very well. That was sort of was to use to fuel the Iraqi invasion. And the same even was even true of ISIS. You know, the suddenly the brave freedom fighters in Syria suddenly become members of ISIS, and you know it's not quite clear how they transmute from one to the other. You know, but they were very much the same guys. So terrorism, the war on terror, and so forth, has always been sort of a way of fueling. Getting popular support for basically unpopular foreign intervention.
And there's never sort of that delineation made within the popular sort of narrative of the differences between Sunni and Shia and how, you know, I mean, you look at Saudi Arabia, you know, Shia populations in Saudi Arabia are oppressed. There's all kinds of intricacies within this region that I think get overlooked. I don't know if it's just overlooked by the general public, or if that also extends to people within DC and the media.
I think it's more culpable in DC and the media. I think, yeah, you know, they're amazingly ignorant, not just in the US. You know, it's always amazed me during my career when you talk to politicians, let's say in Britain, you know, people like Tony Blair, you know, a pretty smart politician, that he got involved in this great big war in Iraq without actually knowing very much about it. And this is not about the country. Why didn't they, in some case, it's sort of imperial arrogance, we don't know. I remember talking to an American journalist, senior American journalist in Washington in between the end of 2002 or beginning of 2003. And he was sort of outlining American plans for invading Iraq and what they were going to do there. And I said, well, you know, I forget exactly what he said. I said, I don't think the Iraqis are going to like that very much, you know, their plans to occupy the country and install their own government. And I remember him saying, you know, well, who cares? Who cares what the Iraqi people think, you know? And it turned out there were very good reasons for caring what the Iraqi people think. But there's a sort of imperial arrogance there. And that's, you have that with politicians and you have that with journalists. Probably a little bit more with politicians.
Do you think that's what has led to this isolationism and sort of military chauvinism with Trump, these sort of failures of the neocon era, sort of coming back to haunt us, where a lot of people feel like, oh, we couldn't take Iraq, we couldn't take Afghanistan, we're sick of losing these wars, we want to be the mighty U.S. Superpower again. And Trump is sort of promising that in a way.
Yeah, he's promising that, but also, you know, there's this sort of militarism, there's this aggressiveness, you know, towards Iran, that there's this strange combination of isolationism, let's get the hell out of these places, and let's stick it to the other side. And you never quite know which one is going to come out on top.
It's interesting because it sounds like what you're saying is that the sort of DC, you know, Washington playbook establishment and Trump both really neither provides a really good way forward when it comes to the Middle East. And, you know, as you point out in the book, the Middle East has in a lot of ways been a political graveyard for politicians since the late 20th century.
Yeah, that's true. I think it always looks easy, you know, it's get involved in Lebanon, get involved in Syria or Iraq. The enemy always looks sort of a bit weak. But in a way, that's the problem, that you know, there's no government to overthrow, or you can overthrow the government, but there's still guys who are fighting you. And, you know, there's an extraordinary sort of list of American presidents and U.S. prime ministers who've gone down because of the Middle East. You know, Tony Blair's reputation never really recovered, but then Anthony Eden, the Suez Crisis in the 1950s, that finished him off earlier in the century. Lloyd George, British Prime Minister, backed Greece against invading Turkey, disaster. You know, we have Carter, Jimmy Carter, intervening, tried to rescue the hostages. Quite a lot of this not his fault, but that basically finished him off. Reagan, you know, the Iran-Contra. Bush intervention. I mean, not all these people immediately went down, but they're basically their reputation, either they did or their reputations never recovered. But go back to another point you were making, you know, why it's easy to see what's wrong with Trump. You can see the ignorance, but why is it do you have the sort of foreign policy establishment, or maybe the establishment in general, getting involved in this again and again? The people are meant to be the sort of grown-ups in the room. And this just doesn't apply to the Middle East. You know, why do we have a sort of a so-called Cold War restarting against Russia and China and to a degree Iran? I think partly because these old establishments figures, these old establishments, they felt comfortable in the Cold War, the old Cold War. That's where they came from. That the institutions they worked for that were sort of set up to face the Soviet threat. And they feel comfortable in that world. So as soon as, you know, you see the way these sort of military political establishments and elites sort of seem very comfortable with the idea of a new Cold War and confrontation, because that's the sort of world they understand. And they're not so happy in the world of sort of pandemic and climate change and all these actually the real challenges that are there, rather than these sort of imaginary ones and the sort of constant threat inflation.
Now, moving on to the subject of ISIS, you've written, you know, more than one book on ISIS. This is not the only one. What sort of is the story of ISIS that we're not necessarily getting? Why it fell? Was it, you know, Trump's bravado that took down ISIS? What's the reason for the fall of ISIS?
It's sort of, in a way, self-inflicted. You know, its strength was that it was this, you know, completely fanatical organization, believed it was inspired by God, with people who would fight to the deaths. You know, it used its suicide bombers on an industrial scale. It also was militarily pretty sophisticated. But it made enemies of the whole world. They were quite a strong position when they took Mosul in 2014 over in Baghdad. Just afterwards, they were coming down the road towards Baghdad. But suddenly, in August, they attacked the Kurds instead. Similarly, in Syria, why did they do it? Maybe because the Turks encouraged them to do it. But they were very happy to consider the whole world their enemy. And eventually, they were just borne down by having enemies everywhere.
Well, as you put it, they were able to use the internet, really, and social media to sort of inspire a sense of terror in their enemies. But I think what they didn't count on was at the same time, you know, they were really getting those enemies angry and those enemies mobilized by doing that.
Yeah, in Iraq, you know, in Baghdad, it wasn't, you know, you had the Shia religious leader, Grand Ayatollah, Ali Sistani called for people to join to help the army. You know, suddenly there were 100,000 sort of volunteers militiamen rushing to the front to stop ISIS, that kind of worked. So, you know, that type of terror, you know, frightens a lot of people. And they were very terrifying. You know, they put up these videos of them sort of massacring hundreds of people and throwing their bodies into the Tigris River. And, but of course, it also mobilized their enemies. So they ended up fighting the Baghdad government. The Kurds in both kinds of Syria and Iraq would have initially didn't want to fight them at all. They much preferred ISIS to go and fight the central governments. But they attacked the Kurds. That, of course, brought in the U.S. in Iran. In Kurdistan, in Iraq, you know, when they attacked, the Kurds are suddenly being supported by American aircraft and Iranian heavy artillery. So they really did make sure that they sort of that they had an awful lot of enemies, and that's what defeated them. They also were completely sectarian, of course, that they massacred Shia. So guys had no alternative, in, whether you're in Damascus or Baghdad, but to fight back.
You know, I think that that's an interesting point, because it seems like one of the reoccurring themes we're getting around to in this conversation. I think it also sort of, you see it in your reporting in War in the Age of Trump, is, you know, when it comes to the grand chessboard geopolitically in the Middle East, it seems like all sides suffer from hubris that may, you know, ultimately backfire on them in the end, whether it's the U.S., ISIS, Soleimani.
Yeah, they do. It tends to go to their head. They tend to, because it's quite easy to intervene and think that you're getting somewhere, and then things fall apart. Why do they fall apart? Well, I think because power is fragmented there. That's why it's easy. Why the first day of a war in the Middle East is always the best for the person intervening, for the aggressor, because power is fragmented. Then once, let's say, you've occupied Iraq, in the case of the U.S., or all the other sorts of power begin to unite against you. You know, when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, it might have looked, you know, as though they were in a strong position. Actually, they were in a rather weak position. Why? Because the Shia wanted them in to get rid of Saddam, but they wanted to take over from the Sunni. They didn't want the Americans to stay. They wanted American occupation to go on just long enough to get rid of the Sunni rulers. The Sunni found they had nowhere to go but to fight, and they really did fight very hard. The Kurds sort of were quite happy for the Americans to be there, but then they weren't occupied. So I think that sort of, you have that sort of hubris. You don't have another hubris, which is just, you know, Western powers tend to underestimate other people. You know, there's an imperial mentality there. You know, I remember in Beirut in 1983, you know, you had the Americans sort of waltzing in. The Marine base down by the airport, you had the French further up the hill, you know, and one day suicide bombers attacked both, you know, 240 American Marines dead, 50-something French paratroopers. You know, there's a sort of, the imperial powers tend to have this sort of arrogance. And they don't seem to learn from events, you know. After what had happened in Iraq, you know, you would have thought that might have been a warning of maybe not get rid of Gaddafi in Libya, because that'll lead just murderous anarchy. But Hillary Clinton seems, you know, Hillary Clinton said when Gaddafi was killed, you know, we came, we saw, he died. You know, this sort of nonsense like this. I mean, very offensive nonsense like this. And then you have Syria, and which they reduced to a sort of perpetual state of civil war. There's a sort of division. Artificial, the media tends to divide these into sort of black hats and white hats, good and bad, and sort of demonizing Gaddafi. Yeah, no, Gaddafi, not so great. Certainly a dictator, you know, certainly pretty offensive in many ways. But what's the alternative? Well, actually, the alternative is a bunch of militias, heavily criminalized, and the country breaking up, and, you know, disaster for 7 million Libyans. Same thing happened in Syria. So there's a sort of lack of any sort of learning there.
It's not too dissimilar, I think, from some of the lessons not necessarily learned with the Vietnam War. I mean, I think the Vietnam War, in a way, is a classic case of elite failure. I mean, I always think about Robert McNamara never being able to come to grips with his role in that war. And I think you see the same thing with the modern 21st century wars in the Middle East.
Yeah, you do. And I think sort of great powers and powerful countries, they can't quite believe they've intervened in a small place and are suffering such damage. You know, it's the British were the same under the British Empire. You know, they intervened in Ireland, you know, did them tremendous damage. South Africa, you know, they're fighting a bunch of Boer farmers. Again, they did them a lot of damage. So so I think that, you know, that happens all the time. I think as regards ISIS, excuse me, they tend to think these are a bunch of fanatics, true, guys who want to go back to, you know, to the days of Muhammad, very weird, unbelievably violent. But these guys were militarily pretty skilled. People tend to underestimate that. It's one of the reasons they took Mosul. But afterwards, fighting for Mosul, the U.S. generals thought it could take 2 months. It took 9 months. These guys, you know, they knew how to fight on the ground. They would, you know, have small units. They'd take over a house. They'd build tunnels from a house, either in the old city of Mosul, your cellars. They'd build them below ground. In other more modern houses, they build it above ground. You know, they'd go into a house, set up a sniper show, use the snipers or rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and then they'd rush out of it before the U.S. air power or artillery or something hit that house. You know, so they fought pretty hard and pretty effectively. Earlier, when the U.S. was in Iraq, you know, they were amazed that, you know, that the other side had this actually pretty sort of sophisticated campaign of explosive devices, IEDs everywhere. You know, they really were pretty effective. So again, I think they were caught by surprise by that.
Now, we mentioned before the Kurds. When Trump withdrew from Syria, the immediate reaction was, Trump has betrayed the Kurds. And now, you know, the Kurds do seem to be in a very dire predicament. What do you make of that predicament? And also, what has your experience been reporting on the Kurds, talking to leaders within the different Kurdish parties?
Well, you know, what Trump said is a terrible mess, we'll pull out. He's quite right, it was a terrible mess. But he also betrayed the Kurds, which were the U.S. allies. Kurds, it's almost impossible position in Syria because so long as the U.S. is there, they're reasonably safe. But at the end of the day, maybe at the beginning of the day, Turkey matters more to the U.S. than the Kurds. So already the U.S. has let the Turks move into northern Syria, into Kurdish areas. There are at least 100,000 refugees, people who have fled, will never be able to go back. So, you know, the Kurds are in this sort of dysfunctional marriage where they have to stick with the U.S., who are, on the one hand, a kind of defender against the Turks, but they're also sort of continually betraying them to the Turks. The Kurds really don't have any good options. What should they do? They need, in the long term, probably the best for them would be to have some autonomous relationship with the central government, with Assad. Not that I think Assad is in any way trustworthy, but he might have to, not be strong enough to actually take over Kurdish areas on the ground. because the alternative is at some point the US is going to go, and at some point the Turks are going to move in further, and they're just going to expel all the Kurds. We're going to have ethnic cleansing. So they're in an impossible position. Iraq's slightly stronger position, but they overplayed their hand a bit. You know, the Kurds, when the Kurds were fighting ISIS, they were in a quite sort of strong position. But as soon as that was over, they were overextended. And unless they were going to get really big support internationally, particularly from the US, they couldn't hold the ground they'd taken. But it's a pretty miserable situation. I mean, I remember in Syria, Kurds there, they're just saying, what should we do? And I just couldn't, you know, there isn't a good answer. There isn't a good solution.
Do you feel that a lot of this, that maybe we could have seen it coming in hindsight? Do you ever feel that way with regards to your reporting? Because you switch between sort of looking back at your reporting and also, you know, having the eyewitness reporting at the time within the book.
Yeah, that's very sort of deliberate, because I think one needs to show what things looked like at the time, you know, to describe, you know, what actually happened on the ground, and then look retrospectively of, you know, what did this mean or what was happening. So, you know, so I have a lot about the siege of Mosul and what was happening there. You know, the fighting elsewhere, and then try and sort of put it in a more general context. You know, and these are very strange countries. You need to explain to people what, so far as one can, what they're like, you know. I remember I actually quote, I think, in a sort of introduction to the book, something that happened to me. One moment I was in a car with some Iraqis north of Baghdad, in an area which ISIS had controlled, which is considered dangerous. And I was driving along the car, I put my seatbelt on, and Iraqi suddenly said, take your seatbelt off immediately. No Iraqi wears a seatbelt. If you wear a seatbelt, then people will immediately see you're a foreigner and will be in danger. It never occurred to me. I kind of knew that Iraqis were kind of didn't really wear seatbelts in cars, but it hadn't occurred to me that if I wore a seatbelt, that could immediately identify me as a foreigner. So these, you know, these places have very distinct traditions and habits, they're very interesting places. You know, in Iraq, I mentioned that power is fragmented, but Iraqis say, you know, that there are four powers that. There are the government, obviously, but there are also the tribes. And they're not just the tribes, but they're what's called the Marjiya, which is the religious hierarchy of the Shia, immensely powerful. And then you have the paramilitaries, the Hashd al-Shaabi. They're another power. And Iraqis are very conscious of that. You know, Iraqis will say, you know, if you have a tribe accent, it's not if you're right or wrong, but what tribe you belong to. And it's not, you know, it's even more complicated than that. But are you a Sunni or a Shia or a Kurd? You know, all these things matter in daily life. And the same is true in Syria. I always feel people get Syria completely wrong because they don't understand the degree to which it's a sectarian country. There was a brief moment in 2011 during the Arab Spring where people came together to ask for democracy. But overall, this is a very sectarian country divided by religion. Which is run, the government is Alawite. It's a form of Shiism. You know, they're probably, that's one of the reasons Assad has been so hard to overthrow. Because maybe you have, you know, maybe 2.5 million Alawites there, but that's enough to create crack units in the army and supply the officer corps and staff the security forces. And this was true from the beginning. I thought a lot of the reporting never really admitted how sectarian all this was. You had an uprising, but it was basically a Sunni uprising. And it was of, you know, religious Sunni, particularly rural Sunni, very religious, fundamentalist. And this was taken over by ISIS and people. This was often presented in the outside world, that you'd have spokesmen for the opposition, you know, who seemed to be very secular and, you know, spoke excellent English and Said how they wanted to bring democracy to Syria. But then you discover these guys could not themselves go back to Syria. They had absolutely no influence on the ground. The CIA once worked out there were 1,500 different arms groups in Syria. So you had all these different armed groups. I think in Syria, the reporting was particularly, Western reporting was particularly bad. They sort of presented a sort of Assad as a complete demon. And there's something to be said for that. You know, this was a violent autocracy that took and held power by extreme violence, murdering and torturing people. It was, basically came from one religious sect. But the other side was also based on a single sect. You know, what holds the opposition? Because basically the minorities in Syria were all terrified of the sort of a takeover by the Sunni. Not just the religion, but the Kurds. The Kurds originally didn't much like Assad, but they were even more frightened of the other side.
Isn't that true of the Druze as well? They were they don't necessarily like Assad, but they're also afraid of the Sunnis.
You bet they are. Yeah, you know, because you know, but when a few years ago, you know, a Druze village was taken over by one of the fundamentalist groups, you know, and said, well, I said, no, we don't mind the Druze staying here, but you will all have to change your religion to our version of Islam. And then there was a fight, and I think 22 people got killed. You find that with the Druze, the Ismailis, the Kurds, the Christians. You find the Christians, generally support Assad.
It's odd because when you point these things out to people, I think people jump to, oh, you're automatically supporting Assad, or you're automatically supporting Gaddafi. And it's not about supporting a Gaddafi in Libya or an Assad in Syria. It's about pointing out that there's these multiple interests at work, and they're, you know, isn't necessarily good guys and bad guys. This isn't a movie.
Yeah, no, exactly. And of course, the opposition wants to, as any opposition would, and I would do if I was them, want to present themselves as the solution. That, you know, they would say all the problems of Iraq are the result of Saddam. We're not really divided by religion and so forth. So a few of them hadn't been back to Iraq for decades, so they didn't actually know what was happening in Iraq. Others were just cynical. Iraqis are pretty good survivors. I remember a conference of the Iraqi opposition in London just before the 2003 invasion. An Iraqi friend of mine said to me, you know, I just hope the Americans don't realize before this happened that what they're about to do is not in their interest. And of course it wasn't. A lot of this was, you know, very predictable from the beginning and still is. But you look at the whole sort of the history of the last, since the 90s, the Clinton intervention in Somalia ends in disaster. We have Iraq, we have Afghanistan, we have Libya, we have Syria. It's all disaster. Of course, it's primarily disastrous for the poor people who live there. You know, not many people in Washington, D.C. got killed in these places.
Yeah, I've always felt particularly bad for Afghanistan. I mean, when there was this idea that, oh, we're going to go into Afghanistan and we're just going to liberate them, I'm just thinking about, you know, people living in the hills in Afghanistan, the Pashtun tribes. They're not playing the same game as neocons. They don't care, and they're not going to let you come in there.
Yeah, I remember once talking to a Pakistani colonel just on the other side of the border, but in a Pashtun area, and he was commanding Pashtun troops. And he said to me, you know, I'm really interested in this sort of American-British thing of learning, sort of winning hearts and minds. He said, I've been commanding Pashtun troops, for, you know, for a long time. And I have noticed one thing about Pashtun culture, he said, which is that they really hate foreigners. And it sort of lived with me, you know, that Pashtun, they really don't like foreigners. And once you know that, you know an awful lot about what was always going to happen there if the Americans and the Brits and stuck around, which was they were going to fight. I think there's another thing, you know, not quite recognized, regional. You know, why did the U.S. never, how did the Taliban hold out? You know, there are an awful lot of Afghans, they're not Pashtun. They don't like the Taliban. How did they hold out? Well, they got supported by Pakistan. You know, in these cases, regional powers, they really didn't like the U.S. there. You know, in Iraq, the U.S. was there. I remember the then Iraqi foreign minister saying to me, he said, you know, the crucial thing you've got to realize here, there's none of the neighboring powers like the U.S. occupation. Quite glad to get rid of Saddam. They don't like a big U.S. army here. So you had primarily Iran and Syria, but actually all of them sort of made it kind of easier to for jihadis to get to Iraq to attack the U.S. Same thing in Afghanistan. And that was part of the sort of hypocrisy that it should have been pretty obvious from the beginning. The U.S., there was no point in the U.S. keeping an army in Afghanistan so long as the Taliban were supported by Pakistan. If they really wanted to win, they had to confront Pakistan. But then they were confronting a very large, powerful army with nuclear weapons. They weren't prepared to do that. But once they weren't, then the game was lost. Basically this similar situation. So what you have in Iraq and Syria and these places is that you have a fragmented country, you have local power centers, and then they plug themselves in to foreign powers. You know, you start a war, you need a lot of money, it costs a lot of money, you need a lot of weapons, you know, you need ammunition and so forth. And that's one of the things that makes Iraq so unstable, that when some faction, some party inside the country is doing badly, they look for a foreign sponsor. And that keeps the war going.
Now, before we close out, I just had two more things I wanted to cover real briefly, if you have the time. The first is, you mentioned that there's some updates you have from Damascus.
Well, yeah, I had a friend of mine was interviewing various people in Syria. One thing that's sort of very striking is that the pandemic has really taken off there. You know, it was slow to come, but it really is. There's one guy we interviewed in a hospital, hospital nurse, says, you know, first of all, the government figures are far less than 10%, he says, of what some people have really got it. You've got to take a small bus in Damascus, you know, practically nobody is wearing masks. People are crowded together in the markets, you know. Always, you know, it's a very sort of overpopulated city. It's got lots of displaced people in it, but the streets are always sort of crammed with people. So it's not surprising it spreads pretty fast. The hospitals are completely overburdened. Another guy who got it was saying to us that many of his neighbors won't admit it. He actually admitted it to people and discovered this was a really bad idea, because then he was treated by a pariah when he went to buy stuff from the shops, the shopkeepers would all scream at him, get away, get away. So he had to walk, although he had coronavirus himself, he had to walk to another district 45 minutes in order just to get by sort of, you know, fruit and vegetables and so forth for himself. Now, this has been exacerbated by the Caesar Act, which is this toughening on passed on the 17th of June. And in a completely hypocritical way, this is supposed to strengthen sanctions in order to safeguard Syrian civilians. And it's very much like sanctions we used to have against Saddam. They don't hurt the leadership. They do hurt ordinary people. But when you are short of resources, the leadership have got the capacity to get their hands on it. Ordinary people don't. So this meant you have collapse of the currency. Everything is sort of suddenly very expensive. People have to choose between whether they're going to buy a mask because of the coronavirus, or are they going to buy bread. So normally they will buy bread. And one guy we interviewed said, look, you know, if I don't wear a mask, if I don't have any medicine, if I go outside, I might get coronavirus and then I might live or might die. But if I don't have bread, then we're all going to starve to death anyway. So people choose to buy food. So the Caesar Act has sort of has exacerbated the situation. You know, it means it's pretty, it seems to me pretty disgusting, but it's not going to bring down Assad. One of the ideas is that the US and its Western allies should prevent Iran, Syria, and Russia winning a conclusive victory in Syria. But the people who suffer from all this are the ordinary Syrians, you know, who are beginning to die in, you know, quite significant numbers. According to some reports, you know, the government is burying people secretly.
Isn't that also true of Iran with the sanctions there?
Yeah, I think that you know, that does. That's the impact it has. It doesn't, and of course it doesn't, you know, in some ways, I suppose you could say, does it weaken the government? Well, you know, it makes their country much poorer and so forth. But in some ways it strengthens them because they can blame all this on the US and the West, which is what Assad and his people are doing now. I mean, up to a couple of weeks ago, they were saying they were playing down the coronavirus and saying we got it under control simply by announcing figures that were far less than the number of people who got it. Now they're not doing that. They're just playing up the fact that the Caesar Act has prevented them being able to cope with the virus. Now, that doesn't mean people will love Assad any more than 20 years ago they loved Saddam, but it does mean they don't consider Western intervention as being in their interests. And remember, you know, what happened in Iraq and Syria, you know, there was in the West and there was a feeling, you know, just let it bubble. It doesn't make any difference. But what did it produce? You know, it eventually produced ISIS. It produced, you know, a great flood of refugees into Europe, which kind of politically destabilized a lot of countries. That you can't let these sort of this sort of mess go on and on, and think it won't infect the rest of the world. It does.
That actually leads into the last point I wanted to make, and then I'll let you go. Is you know, looking around, I feel as if whether we like it or not, the U.S. and the NATO powers, I'm not sure how much control you can have over other regions of the world. I'm not sure you can go on with forever wars and, you know, trying to sort of contain Russia at all times. I feel as if, you know, something has to give. And I don't want the U.S. to go into the direction of the Trumpian sort of isolationism, but I also think that this, we have to intervene constantly, and there's no other way about it. U.S. sort of has to assert its dominance. I don't think that's the way forward either.
No, particularly as that policy has, you know, failed repeatedly over the last 20, 30 years. But, you know, the sort of Washington sort of foreign policy establishment, the Pentagon, you know, that's kind of what these guys do. You know, you have think tanks that sort of think about that. So people have jobs there. You have the Pentagon, you know, people have jobs there. You have I think there's also a very dangerous thing, which is preoccupation with, you know, the Russian threat. Now, how threatening is really Russia? You know, what is the strength of Russia? Not that great, you know, because exaggerated during when it was the Soviet Union. I think it's even more exaggerated now.
I remember, real quickly, I was going to say, I remember when Obama said something that I think probably hurt Putin more than anything anyone else has said. He said they're a regional power when he was trying to do the Russian reset. He's saying, you know, they're really not that strong.
Yeah, people are as strong as you sort of take them to be. You know, if you treat them as a regional power, then other people begin to think, God, you know, we don't like those Russians. We've got to take them real seriously. Similarly with Iran, you know, treating them as the great sort of threat. You know, in some ways, it's rather flattering to Iran. But it has this very negative thing, you know, the world really is. We've just seen it over the last, you know, 6 months with the pandemic. There really are real challenges out of there, not, you know, which not threat inflation, you know, which may be due to the pandemic, maybe, you know, climate change. And this type of sort of new Cold War is a sort of return to the past by sort of elites, just like sort of Trump has his sort of return to the past, to the America of the 1950s and so forth. And in some ways, it's even more lethal, because they aren't going to cope with the real challenges which are there. You know, who took pandemics seriously, you know, until about sort of 6 months ago? It was something out there. It was something that happened in the Far East. It was something that usually when you heard it on the radio, it turned out to be exaggerated, but it wasn't. Climate change, people talk about it endlessly, you know, but at some point it will be there. You know, that the China and the U.S. are confronting each other in Japan over islands, you know, sandbanks and the South China Sea. They're going to be 6 feet underwater fairly soon. So I think that this is sort of, is all very negative, what they're doing. I think this obsession with Trump as being, you know, the demon who, and who once that demon is vanquished, things will come right, just isn't so. They'll find that out. We'll all find that out. But it's this inability to sort of face up to real challenges, which I find most worrying.
Do you think the sort of reality of it, I know there's been a lot of talk about we're sort of moving towards a multipolar world. You know, the U.S. isn't going to be the only superpower. Do you think that's where things are headed? Or what is the way
forward? Already there. I mean, you know, why didn't they win the war in Afghanistan? Well, you could have tactical explanations. But the basic thing, as I just said, is they couldn't confront Pakistan. They wouldn't confront a regional power there. So already we have a multipolar world. You know, why couldn't they win in Iraq? Well, because to do that, you'd have to invade Syria and invade Iran as well. You know, you have Trump, you know, a U.S. force, you know, in northeast Syria looking to intimidate Assad and do lots of other things there. And what's really dishonest is say these things could be done, but by the way, we'll need 150,000 troops. It'll probably take us 10 years and we still mightn't win, you know. So I think we already are in a multipolar world. And there's, you know, Trump in some ways want to return to a sort of a mythical past in the US, but his opponents also want to return to a past where they, you know, they were engaged in cold wars against Russia and the Soviet Union and China and elsewhere, and you know, that's not what they should be doing at the moment. So I'm sorry to sound so gloomy, but I think it is a rather depressing prospect.
I guess that's what I meant when I said, what is the way forward? Is there a way to thread a needle and not be the Trumpian isolationist, but also not be the new Cold War hawk? Like, where do you think things would go if we were to go in a more positive direction?
It's difficult to know, but, you know, can you sort of, supposing Trump loses, can you sort of go back to sort of what things were like under Obama, you know, but maybe things have gone too far, you know. Also, you know, the U.S. is much weaker because they're obsessed. Everybody is absorbed by political divisions within the U.S. The you know, how much interest would there be in these foreign interventions? So I think it's difficult to see these things getting better.
Well, Patrick Coburn, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax News. How can my listeners get a hold of War in the Age of Trump and keep up with your writing?
Well, I think if they just go to the website for All Books or Verso Books, or they can simply go to Amazon.com. So very easy to do. Or they could even go to a bookshop if they're open and buy it there. I think that, you know, people have been thinking about the pandemic the whole time. But, you know, none of these issues have gone away. And in some ways, they've been getting worse all the time. And also what happened in the Middle East is really, that's where the sort of tectonic plates of world conflicts and confrontations meet. You know, Iraq is not just about Iraq. It's the really the sort of battle arena for the whole world. The same is true of Syria. That's one of the reasons why it's important, not just as regards to smallish countries in the Middle East, because this is where, as I said, the sort of the real tectonic plates meet and where the real political and military earthquakes take place. That's why it's interesting and significant.
Well, as I said, I want to thank you again for coming on the program, and I highly recommend people pick up War in the Age of Trump, because, you know, we live in an age of outrage and, you know, the new news story every, you know, 5 seconds, it seems like, but you're keeping up with the stories in the Middle East, and we sort of need to remember and collate what's been happening historically there within the past few decades, and you're doing just that. So I want to thank you for all your great work.
No, thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Patrick Coburn, the prolific war correspondent and author of War in the Age of Trump, The Fall of ISIS, The Betrayal of the Kurds, and The Conflict with Iran. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, and Gratz. Join them in getting your own producer's credit on each and every episode of Parallax Views by contributing at the $10 or $15 tiers on the Parallax Views Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And at the $5 tier, you can listen to the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was, with yours truly and Comrade Casey. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.